Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Rising Coaches Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Bender, and today's episode is brought to you in part by Dr. Dish. Dr. Dish is by far the best shooting machine on the market. And if you want a discount off a new machine, be sure to mention Rising Coaches to save up to $300. For more information, visit drdishbasketball.com or visit one of their social media platforms at Dr. Dish B-Ball. Also, if you're not already a member and are interested in joining the largest coaching tree in basketball, visit risingcoaches.com to sign up today. You'll build genuine relationships with other coaches, have access to amazing content that will allow you to develop your craft, expand your network, and see job opportunities on our member site that won't get posted anywhere else. For more information, visit risingcoaches.com. All right, we have a special guest today, Coach Tyler Costin. Coach, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm excellent. I appreciate being called a coach. You know, officially, I retired from coaching about 15 years ago. But I do like to coach coaches still, so I'll take the honor.
There you go. We're all coaches in some light. We're all teachers. We're all leaders. And I know you check all of those boxes. So tell us a little about your story and kind of how you got to where you are now. Is, you know, you're your own entrepreneur in a way with Savvy, and, you know, talk about that and how you are.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. You know, I joke with my friends when we're out and about. I'm like, you know, what someone does for work is often the least interesting thing about them. And so we try to get away from, you know, what you do. But I think as coaches, what we do is so much more than just a job. For so many of us, it's a calling. You know, I had a plan when I was done playing college basketball to become a lawyer. Went and took the LSAT, the whole thing. And then I was offered an assistant coaching job and fell in love with it, threw away the idea of being a lawyer. And really felt called into this coaching profession. And, you know, I think a lot of coaches probably feel this. You know, we love the competitiveness of it. We love the challenge of it. We love the growth of it. But at the end of the day, it gives you an instant gateway into young people's hearts and minds. You know, if you can help them with this thing that they love, this thing of basketball, they're going to listen to you when you talk to them about responsibility and maturity and ownership and work ethic. And, you know, so for me, you know, basketball is just the tool that gets you in the door, and now the door with other coaches. But really, it is the personal development and growth piece that fires me up. And so I've had the opportunity to do that for the past 13 years with PGC Basketball, Point Guard College. I counted it up the other day. Over the past 13 years with PGC, I was able to run over 200 camps and work with over 20,000 athletes and coaches worldwide, which is pretty crazy. And so got to do that for 13 years. You know, eventually the director of curriculum development and trained all of our directors, decided we ran at all our camps and whatnot. And then more recently, I really felt called to help coaches teach the game new and better. And now I travel around with Savvy, and I coach coaches and work with teams to install our systems. And that's a whole new wonderful challenge. So that's what I've been up to, and I appreciate you asking.
Yeah, definitely. There's always time for good questions. And tell us a little bit about, you know, how you came about learning to, you know, in essence, run your own company. How does that happen? How do you feel like there's no qualification that says I'm going to lead coaches and coach coaches? Where did you feel and gain that confidence over time, not only with Point Guard College, but actually coaching, to get you to that point? And what have you learned from that? Or what are your kind of your main core values, in essence?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So one of my favorite phrases is this: perfection is the enemy of improvement. Perfection is the enemy of improvement. And I think that if we embrace that more as coaches, I think that our practices will look differently. I think our players would feel differently as we're trying to teach them. I think that we'd probably endeavor to do more things in life, because so many of us, especially so many coaches, we're perfectionists and we want things to be done exactly right. But so often that postpones movement. And, you know, another Chinese proverb that I love is move in the way will open. And so I think core value of believing in movement, believing in growth, has kind of been instilled in me from a very young age. My dad's a professional athlete. He's a professional golfer. He's played on the PGA Tour. I've had him in US Opens. I mean, so he never had a job. He dropped out of college as a junior to turn pro, and has always put food on the table for our family. Sometimes, you know, in an Airstream trailer with being homeless, but always just traveling around just by going earning a paycheck playing golf. And so I think from a very young age that betting on yourself, belief in yourself, willingness to have an adventure and try things was really instilled in me from my dad. And then also, you know, I think, and this is a little bit unique about my journey, but I would really encourage coaches to study something other than basketball. Master a skill outside of basketball, and I think it will make you a better basketball coach. And mine is I'm a real estate investor. And so for the past 15 years, I've been investing in real estate, developing real estate. And I think that that's where a lot of the business side of it came from, was having to make that work, and kind of gave me the confidence to say, I can make this work a little bit as well. You know, this whole savvy framework, which I spell SAVI, is really the four principles, the four lenses that I ask coaches to slip on and try to examine their own blind spots. Because we as coaches, we as leaders, we all have blind spots. But the trouble with blind spots is you don't know what they are. And so a lot of times, like, we're so utterly confident in one thing, whether it be we're confident in what a player is or isn't. We're confident in what our system can do for us. We're so confident in it. And a lot of times, it's not our weaknesses or the things that we're not confident in that cause us to fail. A lot of times what causes us to fail as coaches or causes our teams to fail is the things that we're sure about aren't exactly what we thought they were. We shouldn't have been that sure about them. And so as a savvy coach, we all want to be questioning ourselves. And so these four lenses, SAVI, it's an acronym, are ones that I've developed over the past 15 years and just named it. A savvy coach is one that examines themselves first through the lens of simplicity. Any dumb person can make things more complicated. And we as coaches are constantly adding, oh, let's add this tool, let's add that tool, let's add that tool. We're adding. But the absolute best are the ones that subtract and simplify things, right? Like Albert Einstein said, it takes a touch of genius to make things a little bit more simple. And so simplicity wins. You know, and the quick test that I ask coaches to perform on themselves multiple times throughout the season is line up your 12 players outside your office, bring them in one at a time, and say in one sentence, tell me what's most important to us about our transition, our offense, and our defense. And if all 12 players don't say the same things, you're not simple enough. You're too complicated. They're thinking about different things. You know, everyone might be rowing real hard, but if they're rowing the wrong direction, you're not going anywhere. So that's the first lens, is how simple can you be? Feel free to interrupt me anytime. You were joking about whether I'm a 1 minute answer guy or a 5 minute answer guy. I'm like a 20 minute answer guy, but I'll keep going. But interrupt me at any point. I love interruptions because it makes sure that you get what you want out of it. So the A in being a savvy coach is really a belief about adversity. And the lens that I want coaches to slip on is this lens that believes that adversity strengthens. So many times we want our practices to look good. We want a drill or a new play that we're running to work. And so when things look messy, or when players are making mistakes, or when we're butting heads or there's conflict, a lot of times we shy away from adversity, we shy away from obstacles. But if we adopt the sense of, okay, you know what? The only way to the next level is through the storm, is through the adversity. If we believe that, then we would start to run towards embarrassment. We'd start to run towards tough things. And if we believe that, then you're going to improve. I've never seen a team or a coach or a program improve shying away from adversity. Because that's what allows you to get stronger. And so the third one, the V in savvy, spelled S-A-V-I, is victory is measured. So this is really adopting a data-based approach to things. So many coaches, especially coaches that have been doing it a long time, have really deeply held beliefs about what type of shots win, beliefs about what sort of defense they should run, beliefs about what type of players they should have, beliefs about the best way to teach. Well, what we try to understand is, like, true victory is data driven. True victory is data driven. There, you need to, if it's worth doing, it's worth measuring. when I go in and work with coaches, they'll do a drill. And at the end of the drill, I have a list of questions that I ask coaches when I observe and audit their practices and just provide some ideas for them. And one of the first questions I always ask about a specific drill is, what was your objective in that drill? And they'll say something, right? And they'll say, okay, how do you know if you achieved your objective? Like, well, I felt like we did. And one of the principles I share with them is feel is not real. Feel is not real. I mean, I told you my dad's a professional golfer. Like, it's unbelievable what we might feel we're doing in our golf swing. But then when you look at film, and we all know that film don't lie, we look at film, it's not anything like what we feel that we're doing. But we fool ourselves all the time as coaches as well, because we feel like what we're doing is helping. We feel like, because we, you know, played keep away, you know, with six defenders on five for 20 minutes, we feel like it's going to lead to ball security. But what are you actually measuring? If it's worth doing, it's worth measuring. And if you're measuring it, you better see improvement or stop doing that thing. Because so many times we as coaches waste time doing things that don't actually lead to our desired objective. Victory must be measured. You can't just feel good about a practice. I mean, otherwise you're just going to do the three-man weave all practice. You're like, oh, didn't drop the ball one time, we're going to win. No. No, it's one of the least direct translating things there is in the game. You don't get more of a three-man weave. Okay, I stands for identity commits. No one ever did anything great with half measures. I think I'm going to dabble in this thing. I'm going to try this thing. Like, identity commits is, once you choose an identity because you measured it and you know that's going to lead to victory, then you got to put all your chips in the middle and you got to ride with it. Because so often we pull back, we only do halfway, it doesn't work right away, and so we don't do it any longer. Identity commits and gives everything to what they're doing. And you know, I every single year we've met coaches. There's a legendary Don Meyer story. Young coach is sitting down with an elderly Don Meyer and says, hey, what do you think about this matchup zone? You think it's good? And he's like, oh, but I also really like a pressure man-to-man. You know, this pack line, there's a lot of reasons to do a pack line. And Don Meyer interrupts the young coach and he says, oh, hold up, bud. He's like, you can do anything you want and be good. But in order to be great, you got to pick one thing. And that's just kind of always stuck with me. You can do anything you want to be good, to be great. You got to do one thing. And I think that committing to an identity is just key, because there's so many coaches that have been successful in so many different ways. But unless you're known for something, unless you can hang your hat on something, it's going to be really, really hard to be great, be special. So that's kind of the four lenses that I've discovered through my travels and now apply to coaching coaches.
Great. Yeah. 6 minutes. Not bad. Now you talk about simplicity, you know, clarity gives you power, and you obviously have given that, you know, not spiel, but like how you feel, your core values and how you got to that, I'm sure took a lot of work and time and modifications, and, you know, that's who you are. That's your identity and you committed to it. And that's, you know, in essence, that's now your business and what you do on the daily. You mentioned the word storm. And there's a video that's out there that's probably your most powerful and most popular video that's kind of gone viral. Talk a little bit about that video, how you came up with that, where you came up with the powerful story of what a storm is, and then, you know, fill the other people in on what I'm talking about.
Well, so I don't even know which video specifically. I've recorded so many videos. I'm not even sure which one you're talking about right now. Can you give me a little more context on it? Then I can answer that.
Well, Point Guard College tweeted out a video. It's probably about a year ago. It talks about the power of the storm. And when you get into the storm and the coach is yelling at you and they're doing this and that, and how you handle it, how you handle that. You know, you talked about words like adversity, how you walk that storm and get back to where, hey, how are we productive? How do we get to where what happens next can't be based on how we feel? Yeah, we feel some type of way and the coach overreacted. Talk us through, hey, how you would coach a coach to be better at that.
Well, Brian, first off, you crushed that. Okay, I should have been recording you, and that video is going to go viral. Okay, that was awesome. So I'll give three quick points on that hopefully can really, really serve coaches. Point number one is this. Basketball is a game of mistakes. Basketball is a game of mistakes. And the quicker you as a coach, your players on your team, your whole group and community – can get past it and move on, you're going to be more successful. So a study was recently done on Olympic athletes, the elite athletes and the most mentally tough athletes on the planet. And it found that when their flow state, their concentration, their focus was broken, it took Olympic athletes a full 30 seconds to get back to peak performance. So they were less athletically effective, they were less mentally focused, they were making worse decisions for a full 30 seconds when their focus got broken. They were worse at their sport. Now, if that's an Olympic athlete, imagine the players that we coach. Imagine the players that anybody that's listening to this coaches. It's probably more than 30 seconds. The same study also found that youth athletes, when their concentration was broken, it took them 2 hours to get back to peak performance. So I use that story so often with parents, especially. They're telling little Timmy to shoot it or screaming at little Timmy to get their hands up. It's like you're making little Timmy a worse player by breaking their concentration. And so if basketball is a game of mistakes, I would say it's equally important not just to limit mistakes, because you know we're never going to eliminate mistakes completely. It's more important to spend time training players on how they're going to respond to mistakes. And so that would be point number two for coaches, which would be teach players to respond instead of react. You know, if you think about prescribe some medicine, right? If you have a reaction to the medicine, it's negative. And our first reaction as human beings to adversity is going to be negative. We're going to droop with our body language. We're going to blame someone. We're going to make an excuse. We're going to get angry. We're going to get upset, whatever. But if you were to respond to the medication, that means you're getting better. And the only difference between a reaction and a response is whether or not it's premeditated. Right? A reaction is a premeditated. It's just natural, right? And natural is negative. The immediate is negative, right? But if it's premeditated, if we choose in advance our response to missing a shot, dribbling a foot out of bounds, missing a box out, a player entering the transfer portal or whatever as a coach, right? If you choose your response in advance, then it's going to generally be positive. And so what I ask coaches often is, okay, what percent of your practice and film time do you spend visualizing mistake response, right? We spend most of our time as coaches eliminating mistakes. We break down film, we do drills, right? We try to eliminate mistakes, but we spend very little time preparing for our response to the inevitable mistakes that are going to happen. And so if we prepare for the storm, we prepare for that adversity, we're probably going to respond to it better. And we both know, and this will be the third point, basketball is a game of momentum. It's a game of runs. And if we can do our absolute best to just limit the length of time that the other team has the momentum, which usually is a product of our mistakes, and if we can do something to just try to lengthen the amount of time that we have the momentum, which is generally going to be a product of our response, well, then you're going to be a better team for a longer period of the game. Outside of if you make more shots, if you execute your offense better, just about your mental state. And so the third step in this whole process is going to be actually building habits. And here's a real simple one that I teach players. It's just the two clap method. So we've all done, even as coaches, like the angry one clap, like frustration or letting an expletive fly or throw the clipboard away, like the angry one clap, right? But it would look and feel very weird to be like two claps. Like there's something about that second clap or like beyond the initial response that kind of moves us on. And so what we actually do is we do this in teams that I work with. We do this a fun little exercise where we just popcorn back and forth all the worst things that can happen in an upcoming practice or game. And then a player actually has to practice their response, build the habit of two claps and verbalize what their next best action is. I call it NBA. You want to be an NBA player, you're going to be a next best action player. So if you can move yourself into the present, that's what we talk about with be present, be grounded, as opposed to get out of the past, because if you live in the past, you're going to be frustrated, you're going to be angry, you're going to be disappointed. There's only really negative feelings that come out of living in the past, right? But if you constantly think about the future, that's when you're nervous, that's when you're scared, that's when you're anxious about what's going to happen, right? But if you can be in the present, you only think about action. So what's my two claps, next best action? And so there's been some players that have taken this to all sorts of silly handshakes. I have players doing this to move themselves on and like get themselves out of like their negative thought cycle. And I actually stole that from Tony Robbins. I was at a Tony Robbins event, and he was doing like a live sort of like counseling session with somebody in the audience. And there it was this woman that was just like going in this woe is me cycle. And he's like, pinch yourself right now. And she's like, what? He's like, pinch yourself harder. And he's like, you know why I had to do that? And he's like, I had to do something physical to get you out of a bad mental cycle. And so that's where like the tooth clap or some weird physical action, the quickest way to change your psychology is to change your physiology. And so that tooth clap method or anything physical can be a great way to kind of get yourself out of it. So that's hopefully a couple of tools that can help coaches help their teams and themselves be better with their mistake response instead of their mistake reaction.
Yeah. Mistake responses. I actually use that with my team. We talked about the next best action thing a lot this past year, getting to the next play. You know, we joke with the Ted Lasso thing. I actually have it with me. So we had the goldfish.
Yeah.
Memory. Everybody had one. Just getting to that next play. And then another one we used. Now that you say Tony Robbins, it kind of makes sense. But I worked with a leadership coach named Scott Savore. He's done some stuff with Rising Coaches. He's really powerful, really good. And he has MIT, what's the most important thing? And keeping the main thing to try and stay present, to try and stay in the moment, control what you can control, your focus, your attitude, your effort, you know, your communication. I think the other part of that is your nonverbal communication that you talked about. Hey, pinching, doing things that aren't necessarily with your voice to keep you present, to keep you moving forward and trying to get the quote unquote results that you want.
That's so good.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Scott actually came to one of my sessions about 5 years ago at the University of Washington. He's a great guy. He's spoken at some of the same clinics. Really, really like him. You know, you mentioned something, you know, about like Ted Lasso. And I just want to double down on both that and any other relevant topics. Like the more we as coaches can use images or use like current events or use things that are popular with our players or use shows, instead of because I said so, as other tools, it's so powerful. So I love that you mentioned that one. I would really encourage all coaches, if you haven't watched Ted Lasso, stop what you're doing right now and go watch it. It'll make you a better coach. But like, try to incorporate non-basketball language, images, and ideas into your basketball teaching. And I think you'll find a lot better traction.
For sure. Yeah, the stories are the most powerful because we sometimes don't always remember quotes or different things that are said to us, but we do remember the story that kind of clicks and gets us back to what we're trying to learn or trying to remember.
Absolutely.
So, a challenge, I guess. So the V victory, that's in your acronym for your company. You know, a lot of things that we're taught in today's society is to try and not get caught up too much in winning or losing or, you know, trying not to be attached to outcomes based off how we feel. So talk about why you picked the word victory. Obviously, it's important that we win, especially in our daily lives and what we're trying to do. But is there any reason why you picked victory specifically, which is kind of outcome based?
Yeah. So, yes. And a couple of things I wanted to talk about on this. Let me just make a note here. I intentionally chose victory instead of winning because I think a lot of times winning is how society or our peers define success, like your record. And my intent with victory, besides, of course, the make sure we measure the things that are important to us, is that we define what a victory is. Coach Lester took over a program in California 2 years ago, and a coach that I work with, and he's like, Tyler, this team has not won a game in 3 years. It's my first chance at a head coaching job. I'm nervous, and we're picked to be dead last in our conference. We're not going to be good. How do I keep these players engaged this season knowing that we're not going to win? Like, yeah, it's hard to go through a whole season not win a game, you know? He's like, how do we keep getting better if we're not going to win? And that's, you know, really where I started to define this whole victory concept. And I said, well, you need to define what your victory is separate from winning a game. So like maybe defining your victory is going to be know, the amount of touches you guys get, high fives and fist bumps a game. Maybe defining your victory is going to be the amount of quick passes. One more pass is for an advantage and a shot, regardless if it goes in. Or maybe your victory is going to be around how many fouls you can draw, whatever. But, like, you need to define a victory and not focus on winning, which is what I think you were referring to, right? And so really, like, the difference for me is victory is ours to define for ourselves, and winning is what other people would define for us. You know, and what he found was by the end of the season, they were 500. They made the playoffs for the first time. And that was without focusing on winning, just focusing on victories, which are things that should be within our control. And so that is the intent of it. But also, and this is the thing that I wrote down, you know, I think everything kind of comes and goes in waves, you know, like mid-range was king and now mid-range sucks. And now we're seeing that, okay, because defenses are built to give up the mid-range, there's some value to having someone at the end of the game that can create a mid-range shot, right? So, like, everything ebbs and flows and goes in cycles, right? And, you know, I think one cycle we have been in for a while is this trust the process cycle. And, like, hey, burn your goals cycle. And there's a story and image that I think is really, really valuable that I think coaches should not forget. It's like if we were to, and this is actually a story that another mentor of mine, Mono Watsa, the president of PGC, actually used and taught me. He said, if you wanted to build like a beautiful cathedral, right, and it was going to just be epic, one of the most beautiful cathedrals ever built, he said, if you completely burned your goals and just focused on the process of laying bricks, right, I'm just going to move 100 bricks every single day, right? I'm just going to do the work. I'm going to pound the stone, all of the tropes, right? He's like, at the end of 10 years, all you have is a pile of bricks. It'll be a big pile, but it's a pile of bricks. He's like, on the flip side, if you just like make drawings and you want to have the perfect plan and like just the most beautiful cathedral drawings, at the end of 10 years, all you have is a drawing on a piece of paper. You know, he said, in order to achieve victory, you have to, yeah, have process-based habits, but you also got to define and have a goal and have a vision as well. And so I think that there's value in both, and there's value in letting our competitive drive push us. I mean, Michael Jordan would have never been Michael Jordan if he didn't care so much about winning, right? And so, like, all the great competitors hate to lose. It's okay to want to win. It's okay to fight like hell to win, right? But you just better make sure that you have a plan and you're measuring the right things in defining your own victory so that you can have some joy and happiness along the way as well. So I think there's more of a balance to it than just completely burning your goals and completely not trying to win. I don't think any great competitor would say, yep, I never cared about winning. I've never heard anybody say that, right? But I think it's a fight to define what our daily process is going to be.
Yeah, if you completely ignore winning, you're going to end up fired and not have a job anymore.
So exactly.
I think it's important to renote, but I think that's a really good happy medium. Like it's got the best of both worlds with your habit stacking and, you know, working on the process, but yet having a image or like a, you know, like you said, you keep using the word tangible. And talk a little bit more about that or some maybe outside the box ideas that we as coaches should think about in trying to make things more tangible, like where you could touch it or grade it, or, you know, especially things that are what we call controllable. So we grade it in our program, our focus, our attitude, our communication, our effort individually, but that's still, you know, what would be, you know, subjective versus, right. You know, like what, how would you describe, you know, give us some ideas from a tangible solution type.
Cool. Well, let me ask you this. And of course there's no absolutes in basketball. Except for, you know, the team that has most points at the end of the game wins. But there's very few options. Like, there's a lot of ways to do it. Like, there's not right, wrong. It's just, like, what can you do? So, Brian, in your program, how do you decide who can take what shots? Like, how do you go about that, you and your coaching staff?
So, we've done a few different things, and it's kind of modified over time. As, you know, like right. You said, young coach, I'm still learning what my true identity is as a coach. And yep. It's modified a lot and I've grown a lot in the last 4 years. So we had my first couple of years, we had a shooting challenge and you could earn your license. And if you had room, rhythm, and range, if you had two of those three, you could let it go at any time during the shot clock. If not, it had to be under a certain amount of time in the shot clock for it to be considered a good shot. Or you could have all three of those to make it what would you call a good shot. But you know, we want to follow our rules within our offense, and our rules were very simple. You know, hit the first open man. Mm-hmm. Second one was get a paint touch. How do you get one? Well, you can drive and score. You can drive and kick. You can throw it in the post, in essence, and then get a swing. And if you had those three things, you were able to kind of – it was a kind of a way to kind of collaborate all of those things on the offensive end. And then on the defensive end, hey, number one was talk. Number two was be in the right spot. How you play defense depends on what you're teaching and what you're doing. Like you said, pack defense or, you know, hey, deny, you know, how you guard a screen. Are you in the right spot for us technically of how we taught you to be where you're supposed to be? And then giving max effort. So those are kind of our rules and absolutes that we had on offense and defense. But what is a good shot or what shot you're allowed to take? Well, you know, it's kind of simple as, hey, are you able to make that type of shot that fits within our offense, that fits our rules on the offensive end?
Yeah. So those are really, really good principles. I like what you shared. Let me share what I teach within the race and space offense that I think is even simpler. And the reason being, you know, I'm on a mission to change the way that the game of basketball is taught and played. The majority of human beings on planet Earth playing basketball are youth players. And so, like, my goal is to take the most sophisticated offensive and defensive things that are being done in NBA and WNBA playoffs and then distill it down to a way that I have an AAU program, the Michigan Mystics, actually. They just won their last three tournaments in a row running the lock left defense. And they're practicing 2 days a week for 90 minutes. And half of those 90 minutes is on skill, but they're able to put in the lock left defense. And, like, that's my dream, right? Is like, it can be so simple that it can go in really, really quickly. So everything I'm trying to do is just simplicity wins, simplicity wins, simplicity wins. So here's a tangible way that you can do measurement or shooting that I think can be super, super simple. So let me ask you two more questions. You might have to, if you don't know the exact numbers from your team last season, I know you just got a new head job, congratulations. Just give your best guess. Last season, do you know what your team's offensive efficiency was, like points per possession?
So if I check Synergy real quick while we're sitting here, I bet I could find that. You want me to check it while we're on here?
Check it or just throw out a number. We're gonna apply my shooting ladder, my race and space shooting ladder to your team last year. And my hope is that coaches listening can apply this very simple formula to their 3-point shooting decision making and how they decide who gets to shoot threes. Real, real simple, measurable way.
Yeah, good. So I know for a fact that we are fifth in the country in made threes. But we also attempted the ninth most in the country. We did.
Okay, this will be very interesting for your team then.
Yeah.
So total points per possession.
I guess you're just shy of one.
Okay. That's pretty efficient. Usually is one about around 1 point per possession. So let's go 0.99, shall we?
Okay.
All right. What was your 3-point field goal percentage last season?
35.5, I believe.
35.5. Okay, so coaches, get those two numbers. If you're listening, get those two numbers. Get your points per possession and then get your 3-point field goal percentage from last season. And then here's a real simple way for you to determine if you need to generate more threes or generate less threes. I'm going to teach you how to use a shooting ladder to do that with a really, really simple dial. So if we just take 35.5, okay, 35.5, and multiply it by three, okay, that would actually create a points per possession. When Brian's team last season shot a three, they were going to generate 1.065, so slightly higher than their overall points per possession, 1.065, so a little bit better than a point per possession. We just do that by multiplying. That's what you should do, coaches. Multiply your 3-point field goal percentage times three, and that'll give you your points per possession generated on 3-point field goal attempt. So Brian, by that very simple calculation, what I would suggest to you, if you're still coaching that team, is you guys, even though you were shooting a lot of threes, you weren't quite shooting enough threes. And so I would suggest to coaches that as long as your points per possession on 3-point field goal attempts is greater than your overall points per possession, you need to shoot more threes. Now, what I don't suggest coaches do is tell their entire team, we need to shoot more threes, because what does that result in? Bad threes, bad shots, not the, what you say, room, rhythm, and range, okay? not two of the three of those, maybe zero of the three of those. So instead, and just so you know, Brian, and all these coaches listening, high school coaches, this number is drastically different. I did a clinic just a few weeks ago, and I asked a high school girls coach. I said, okay, how are you guys as a three-point shooting team? She says, we're terrible. We're a terrible three-point shooting team. She's like, I don't let them shoot any threes. They suck. I'm like, okay, yeah, I understand that. I said, well, just tell me, what were your points per possession last season? They were a lower level high school girls team. She said, oh, 0.5. So they were generating 0.5 points per possession last season. I said, hey, just out of curiosity, your crappy three-point shooting team, what was your three-point field goal percentage? And she said, 20%. We were terrible. And I said, okay, interestingly enough, if you multiply 20% times three, you're actually generating 0.6 points per possession on your three-point attempt. So you need to shoot a ton more three. Her mind was blown. She's like, oh my gosh, how do we do this? And so I said, here's how you do it. And I think that it will be an intangible measurement that will get what you want, which are game-like shots. And game-like shots don't necessarily just mean like game spots, game speed. Game-like shots actually means pressure, right? Like that's the biggest difference between practice shooting and game shooting is the pressure, no matter how fast you're shooting. So what I suggest implementing is a shooting ladder. So for 5 to 10 minutes of every single practice, players get to move up or down your shooting ladder. So let's say, Brian, you've got 15 players on your team. Your first five practices, you do whatever shooting drills that you like that fit into your offense and whatever, okay? And you accumulate scores throughout the top score, throughout the bottom score. And after five practices, you should have top to bottom your best shooter at number one and your worst shooter at 15. You have a ladder right there. Does that make sense so far, Brian? Perfect. So then for every single practice after the first five, you just flip between an even day and an odd day. So on an even day, from this point forward throughout the entire season, your number one shooter is going to compete directly against your number two shooter. And whether you do one shooting competition or five, whatever, they're going to compete at the end of your shooting ladder time for that day. Either your number one shooter stayed on top, the number two shooter stayed at number two, or they flipped. They can only move one position. You do it all the way down, 1v2, 3v4, all the way down. If your 15 shooter doesn't get to play anybody, well, they suck anyway. They're going to stay at 15, okay? That's what it is. So then the very next day, you flip to an odd day. And for your shooting time, whatever shooting competition that you're doing, your number one shooter gets a bye on an odd day. They stay at number one. They earned it. They're your best shooter. Two plays three, four plays five, and on down the line. And you keep switching between even and odd because that allows shooters to get a chance to move their way up. So if we took Brian's team last season and we did our shooting ladder, what Brian would then decide is he'd be, okay, I want my top seven shooters to have their shooting license because I know that this number seven shooter, I know that I want him shooting based on his percentages and games and game makes, right? But this number eight shooter, I don't want him to have a shooting license. So you just arbitrarily pick a number. And then after your first 2 weeks of games or whatever it is, you take a look at your calculation again, points per possession versus three-point field goal percentage. You're like, oh gosh, we got to shoot more threes. We got to shoot less threes. And the simplest way, because you never change your room, rhythm, and range, the simplest way to keep good threes being taken but get more threes is, say, instead of top seven having their shooting license, we go top nine or we go top 10. And so the three benefits of this are, one, every time you shoot on the ladder, there's pressure. It matters to players because there's their name's up on the board. It's public, and it determines whether or not they get to shoot in games or not. The second benefit is they're probably going to get in the gym more on their own because they have a chance to either shoot more or shoot less based on their performance every day in practice, not just what their coach is deciding arbitrarily. The third benefit is it's objective. Coach isn't saying, I think you're a good shooter, I think you're a bad shooter. It's just like, it's right here. You got to move into the top nine or the top seven or top eight, right? And on the flip side, the same thing can happen. Let's say that eventually your overall points per possession is higher than your three-point field goal percentage multiplied by three. Well, then you got to turn down how many threes you're taking. So you just say, hey, we got to turn it down. We're going from nine to six or whatever it is. And that I found is just like the simplest, most direct way to get the outcome we want, which is control over our three-point field goal attempts, competitive shooting drills in practice, and overall a better shooting team. It also leads to more confidence. Like when players know that they've earned it by winning their way up the ladder, they're shooting with a ton of confidence in games. And so it just is a simpler way to do it. So that would be one measurable thing. And we built these things into each layer of the race and space offense. But that would be an example of the tangible measurement.
That's great. I think that's really good. So I did, I don't know if the data matters at this point, but we were a little off. So we were okay. 0.86 in terms 0.86. Of our points per possession.
Yep.
And defensively, we were 0.82. So that's pretty good.
Okay. That is good.
For that advantage.
It was 35, was 35%.
We were 35 point or 34.6.
Cool. So I mean, so what that means, Brian, is so like you're actually still about 105 on threes, points per possession, 0.86 otherwise. So like I would have turned the dial way up. And you know, why a lot of coaches don't do that is they're like, I don't want bad shots. Right. And so I think that's why like your shot selection criteria never changes, just how many people get to shoot changes. And when we apply the data to it across all levels, coaches are like, oh my gosh, I need to let more people shoot. And that's probably one of the biggest blind spots that I found.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, we attempted the ninth most threes in the country at 28.7. And it's crazy, but at the same time, like I still felt we took a lot of bad ones. So as a coach, in your heart, you're like, man, it was quicker. It's time and score too. So that's another thing that's come into play with the data and the drills and all the other stuff is like understanding, hey, we just missed three in a row. And you talked about it, the mistake response. Well, there's also some with momentum as well. And that's absolutely one thing. Sticks don't always contribute into those things of like, hey, what happened on the previous shot? Even though you're not attached to that last outcome, there is some data behind a little bit up in your head. So, you know, it's kind of unique to think about. And I like it. And I love to shoot the threes. So it's not like, you know, each year we've shot more threes. And then we've been one of the top offensive rebounding teams as well. So that kind of helps. If you shoot them, you can go get them. And if they know they're good shots and they're going to go up, you're better chance of getting that offensive rebounds there too.
Yeah.
Also helps when you got guys that can make them. You know, at the end of the day, they got to be able to make the shot.
They do. And I'll share this with everyone listening. So I was in a conversation with a Power 5 coach that made it to the Elite 8 last season about this specific topic. And we got this place where he just basically said, I hate watching misses. He's like, you know, we were talking about, hey, would you rather go 5 for 10 from two? You know what I mean? Or would you, or go like, you know, 3 for 12 from three, you know? And he's like, I just can't handle two more trips, you know, seeing misses. It feels like we failed on the trip, you know? And so like being NATO, N-A-T-O, not attached to outcome as a coach is huge as well. Because like, I mean, a shot's good or bad when it leaves the hand. It's not good or bad when it goes in or not. And that's what I love. I mean, one thing I love about, you know, Brad Stevens when he was coaching, is I just love to watch him on the sidelines. And when they got the right shot out of the right actions, when the shot left the hand, he was clapping whether it went in or not. And if it was the wrong shot, he was coaching whether it went in or not. You know, I can always tell a beginner or a rookie coach, they're watching the ball in the air. And then, you know, they're like, no, yeah. Right? Like this sends the wrong message to your team. And so I think that's a key, you know, three ideas for coaches real quick on how they can have their players make more threes, overall, just big systemic ideas. Like you said, time and score, knowing your players, that's all, you know, going to be unique to you. But one is shoot more threes in transition. It's very, very interesting. Transition threes tend to, across the board at the NBA level, transition threes go in about 8%, the same, contest, distance, shooter, tend to go in about 8% more often. Than against a half-court set defense. 8%, that's a crazy amount. So encouraging, I know like traditionally we're like, no quick shots, you know, those layups, but transition threes tend to generate a little bit higher points per possession. Here's the second one, shoot deeper threes. So as long as, like you talked about, like you want time, one of the easiest ways to get more time or get less contested threes is to shoot from one step further. And to be able to still shoot from that range, you just have to practice from that range. And what I found, like going to work with teams, I can get players to shoot the exact same percentage from one step further within 1 week. It really is just where you're repping and practice it. So instead of playing on the three-point line, playing a step off, what we call the four-point line with our savvy programs, playing on the four-point line and shooting from the four-point line actually increases makes because you get less contest. Most defenses are trained to close out to the three-point line and not beyond it. So that's kind of the second one. And then the third one is just a confidence one. Like once someone's a green light shooter and they have a shooting license, I found great success with actually getting on players for not shooting open shots and make or miss in applauding way to shoot that one in rhythm, way to shoot that one confidently. I love that. And you know, it's why It's like why Mike D'Antoni had players that routinely had career 3-point field goal years when they played for him. It's because he was coaching them to shoot as opposed to coaching them not to shoot. Like, if someone's done the work and they've earned their shoot license, I mean, build that confidence in them, they're going to perform better. So those would be three quick things I think can help your team be a better shooting team, your being everyone that's listening.
You love the three ball. You would agree with that. You believe in it.
Yeah. But, well, yeah, because, I mean, it's not just, like, it generates so many points. It's just the added spacing it gives you as well, right? I mean, basketball is a game of opposites. It's, you know, it's why we have this kind of AV thing. Like, basketball is a game of opposites. If you want more stuff at the rim, which is what we all want, we've got to threaten more stuff outside of three-point line. And so the willingness to shoot, even if they're not going in, will cause teams to have to guard more space, giving you more double wide gaps for driving, giving you more room for post-ups if that's what you do, giving you more room for cuts. So, I mean, it makes your fakes more effective. Like, think about, like, the Villanova series and their catch discipline being weaponized, as I call it, being weaponized on every single catch. Like, either shooting or shot faking every single catch. Well, if there's not a willingness to shoot, that shot fake becomes a lot less effective. It's like Bobby Knight said, the best fake in basketball is a shot fake, right? But of course, you have to be dangerous. You got to be weaponized, right? They have to be worried about you shooting on the scout. But a lot of that even just comes from getting them up. And if you don't get them up early in games, you don't get them up early in season, well, it's going to be really, really hard to get any of your other stuff later in the season. So I do love the three. I think shooting is the separator. I think it's the most important skill in basketball. So much so. I'll say another crazy thing, Brian, because you brought me on to say crazy things. I suggest to coaches that they should spend 50% of their practice time on shooting. Now, I'm not talking like doing, you know, form shots for 50% of their practice time. I think you can get a lot of action-based shooting as well out of your preferred actions, role-specific shooting out of your transition roles. But most coaches like spend a lot of time generating shots because they practice their offense, but they can't actually make the shots, and so they're limited. I mean, shooting wins games. So I believe in shooting across the board, and it's most prevalent, of course, from the three-point line.
There you go. Heard it from the man. Tangible solutions behind it, how to get better in practice. That's great. All good things.
Thanks.
If we were to flip back, is there anything else about the race and space that you want to talk about that, you know, other than shooting, how to make things tangible, how to do things productive in games that, you know, what you call game speed and just overall production, but anything else that you want to touch on?
Yeah. So first off, I've got a 10-page PDF that I just give for free. Anybody can DM me on Twitter at Tyler Costin. Would love to get it to you. You can go to the website, raisingspace.com. There's some free videos on there as well. And basically, it's just broken down 10 layers to improve your ability to play in transition, create more space, create better players, and that's the layer approach. So here's what I try to do with each layer, and what I hope coaches can take away from this is drill for skill, game for reads. Drill for skill, game for reads. If we have all the physical skills to make a pass, but we don't know when to make the pass or who we're making the pass to, and we don't have the read, it's useless. It's useless. And most coaches spend too much time on drills, in my opinion. And they drill these skills, but it doesn't translate to games because it doesn't look very much like the game and the players can't make the reads, right? So whatever your focus or objective is, what I actually teach is an approach of a game sandwich. And I have different game sandwiches in the race and space offense to improve your transition, to improve your spacing, to improve your shot selection, to improve your actions, your zone actions, your advantage reads, all of it, right? Every layer. And a game sandwich is just this. Most of the time when we approach a problem like ball security, hey, we're throwing the ball a little too much. We're like, let's use this one. This one I just worked with the coach on. He's like, oh, Tyler, we were a terrible defensive rebounding team last year. Terrible defensive rebounding team. He said, do you have a defensive rebounding drill that we can do? And I said to coach, I'm like, coach, if you need a rebounding drill to be a good rebounding team, you'll never be a good rebounding team. And the reason is, and I think you know this, Brian, and most good coaches do, is like, okay, that means that you're only focusing your attention and your standards around rebounding for that 10 to 15 minutes that you do the drill. and then you're moving your attention away from rebounding. You don't get good at something just trying to work on it for 10 to 15 minutes a day. It's got to be a part of your identity that you commit to throughout everything that you do. There's got to be accountability in games. You've got to measure it. You've got to reward playing time for it. You got to recruit to it, all of it, if you actually want to be good at that thing. And you can't be good at everything, right? So I'm like, if you just need a drill for this skill, you're not going to be a good rebounding team. We're wasting our time. I said, but if you actually want to get better at it, then I would suggest a game sandwich progression. And a game sandwich is as simple as this. Play a game, whether it be a small-sided game, a five-on-five game, whatever, but it's a competitive game with a winner or a loser where you clearly articulate your objective. I was at a Division II. They went to Division II Final Four this last year. I was at their practice and went through the first 30 minutes of practice. Coach comes over to me after the first 30 minutes and says, hey, Tyler, what do you think so far? And I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, you guys are competing really, really hard. I'm like, what are you working on right now? And he's like, oh, you know, we did our offensive stuff, we did our defense stuff, we did some shooting. I'm like, yeah, but what are you trying to get better at within that? And he's like, oh, you know, he lists out a bunch of things. I'm like, well, by watching you, I have no idea. I didn't hear you say that. They didn't. Like, I had no idea. And, like, they're a great team. Most coaches don't clearly define the objective. So players just go out and play. They go out there with different things on their mind. Like, oh, I'm trying to earn playing time right now. I'm mad at this dude, you know, so I'm gonna try to beat him up right now. Or like, oh, my girlfriend just broke up with me or whatever. Like, they have all this crap in their mind. Like, if they don't have a narrow focus, you're not actually getting better at something. So play a game with a narrow objective and measure it, right? We talked about defining your victory. Then that's the first slice of bread of your sandwich. Then do what I call a skinny. A skinny would be a drill. Okay, a skinny I stole from Molly Miller, Grand Canyon out here. And skinny should be done for a very small, narrow amount of time. Okay, they shouldn't. Most girls go on way too long. No wonder you don't have a great effort. You're doing it too long. Okay, skinny amount of time. They should be done in a really narrow space, like not even at a basket necessarily, but like really, really compressed space. You get more reps in that amount of time, and you can be NATO. When you finish every drill with a shot, well, guess what the players run to the back of the line thinking about? Did my shot go in or not? Not my technique or my read or whatnot. So get NATO. Try to get away from a basket if you can. Like skimmy it up, right? And go really, really hard for that short period of time with a narrow focus on one skill set or one read that you're trying to get better at. That's like your meat in the middle of it or peanut butter and jelly or whatever you're putting in the middle of your sandwich. Then go back to the exact same game. Coaches don't do this enough, right? They play a game like, oh, we got better, and they move on. Right? Well, you just lost most of your improvement. Gain, measure, drill, go back to the same again, do better. And now the players believe in what you worked on, so they'll focus on a little bit more. You've got more confidence in it. You've got actual objective measurements. You actually got better at that thing. You spent a 30-minute progression on something that's really important. You actually got better at it. Apply it to rebounding, apply it to shot selection, apply it to whatever. So there's all these different game sandwiches for each layer of the race and space. And I think it's one of the best things that we do. So I'm pumped up about it. You can probably hear it.
Yeah, you can tell it. You know, one of my core values is passion. You can just, you're screaming through there. Your birds are even happy behind you.
Yeah. We'll do a little skinny with them later. They'll get better.
There you go. Yeah. You should have to be quiet for a while and then let them try another podcast and see if they're
exactly
better.
Exactly.
Perfect. What's one thing that you believe in that other people may think is weird?
That's a really good question. I believe coaches should talk less in practice. I believe that players should talk more. I don't believe in specific to that. I don't believe in concurrent feedback. I think concurrent feedback is the worst type of feedback. So concurrent feedback would be while player is doing drill, I'm like, Dante, peek at the rim. Dante, stop on 2 feet. Dante, pivot. Dante, pass to Jimmy in the corner. Okay, that's all concurrent feedback. I believe it should be completely eliminated. I believe in debriefing over concurrent feedback. After, not just rep, I mean, that's the minimum, is let them do one rep. I prefer 3 reps of uninterrupted training. But even better, at the end of a progression, then debrief. And even when you debrief, talk second. So I believe in first asking a question. Brian, what did you see on that play or team? What's one thing that you think we did really well there? Okay, what's one thing we got to improve on as a team to get better shots? They talk first, we talk second. So I think coaches probably spend, I don't know, what do you think, Brian, on average, you've seen a lot of basketball. On average, what percent of practice time do you think head coach is talking generally across the board?
Just a percentage-wise?
Yeah, percentage. Percentage of total practice time, head coach is talking.
I would say about 40% of the time, maybe 50.
Agreed. Which, and what I found. Yes, a lot, which I found the lower the level of coach, the more they're talking, right? And so my challenge to coaches, hey, go into practice, do two things. One, record yourself the entire practice and then watch it back. Like, what did you say? What was effective? And then two, eliminate half of it. And you cut half of it out. So I think coaches should talk a lot less. I got to be a USA basketball training camp. Might be like 6 years ago now, or it was when it was in Las Vegas, Greg Popovich was there. And for the first 15 minutes, they were going 5-on-0 weave down and then 5-on-5 back getting reps. And it was just terrible basketball. It was the first practice. They'd been out partying the night before, right? It was brutal. And I'm in the stands watching. I'm like, this is terrible basketball. Like, this is embarrassing. These are the best players in the world, and this is what they're doing right now. I'm like, coach, fix this. Coach Popovich, like, why are you not fixing this? And I was getting agitated. I was like, I could go down and fix this right now. I need to go down there. I'm like, I'm probably a better coach than Greg Popovich. And about 15 minutes in, like way longer than I would have let it go, he stepped in. He said one thing. I remember it to this day. He just stopped and he said, are you satisfied with your contribution and performance right now? Are you satisfied? And he went up and down the line. And he pointed, you know, I think Victor Oladipo was there. Vic, are you satisfied? He just went down the line. Devin Booker, are you satisfied? Went on down the line. And everybody said, no, we're not satisfied. And he just said this. He said, huh, I thought it was important to you. And then he sat back down. And the whole practice just changed, you know? And I'm like, oh, man, he was sitting there waiting for the right moment and trying to choose his words to be a surgeon with his words. And the whole practice was different. It was competitive. It was sharp. They were executing. Like, it was great. And so that just really taught me that day that, gosh, it's not how much you say. It's what and when you say. And to be way more strategic with your words.
Yeah, really powerful stuff.
That's
awesome. Yeah, we over-talk a lot. I actually had my assistant that I just got a new assistant this past week. So we haven't worked together. We've talked a lot over the last 3-4 years since I met him. And he was a fellow Rising Coaching guy. And I watched him just do one workout. And I just sat there. You know, I maybe said two things the whole time to the player about stuff that we had worked on previously that he was, you know, hey, quit leaning your head back so your momentum doesn't go backwards every time you shoot it. And get your right foot in front of your left. He always has his left foot behind, so his balance is a little jacked up. But, you know, I talked to the assistant after and I said, have you ever recorded yourself doing a workout? And my first head coach that I worked with at the junior college level, or I guess second, but Thomas Gray, he's now the top assistant at McNeese. He said he made me watch my teachings when we did defense. So like, I hated it. I absolutely hated it, but it was so good for me because I had to, see myself in an uncomfortable position, like you talked about at the beginning, being uncomfortable and doing that to make sure that, you know, what I'm doing is actually productive and how can I say less and do more. And I think it kind of helped me as a young coach evolve and getting those reps. And I say it to coaches all the time, if you want to coach, you have to coach. You have to go get those reps now, early. Don't worry about level. Don't worry about all the stuff at the same time. It's the same. I mean, learn how you talk. Learn how to relate to players, learn how to have power behind what you say, and then be able to do it with clarity and conviction. Because if you do, then you're going to be a better coach over time.
Yeah, that's powerful. The only thing coaches take away from this podcast is to film themselves and watch it. It will have been worth it. Film don't lie.
Awesome. Well, hey, in conclusion here, I try and wrap it up around an hour. You've done a phenomenal job. I think we could probably talk for another hour. But give us, you know, one last word of, you know, any questions I should have asked, I haven't, or something else from a Rising Coach's perspective as you kind of send us on our way.
Awesome. Well, thank you. You've been an awesome host, and I really resonate with everything that you believe in basketball. So I'm going to come swing through Iowa and hang out with you this summer. Coaches, if you ever want to hook up with me, I'm always traveling. I would love to come check out your practice to learn and share. At Tyler Costin on Twitter is the best way to get a hold of me. You know, here's what I would suggest. We believe in the power of coaching. We see its impact on players. If you believe that coaching matters, then you need to be coached. You must be coached. Brian talked about the head coaches that he had coached under. Find a coach that can coach you. And if you want to be coached, that means you want the truth. Like, you can value truth, you can value harmony. And if you want to be great, you got to value truth over harmony. Harmony is like, you're doing great, you're wonderful, you're awesome, and only telling you the good stuff. Right? That's not what makes us better. Like, adversity strengthens. Lean into embarrassment and get some honest feedback. If someone isn't going to be honest with you and point out your flaws and errors and blind spots, they don't truly care about you. Same thing with what we believe for players. Just apply it to yourself. Flip that mirror and go get a coach. And so that's what I'm doing, what I'm doing. But there's so many great, great coaches, four coaches out there. But it is an absolute cheat code in your career and in your growth. Go get coaching.
Perfect. You heard it. You heard it themselves right there. Tyler, appreciate your time. I'm not going to call you coach this time. No. Tyler, appreciate your time and being present for this hour and impacting our lives and leading others. And look forward to meeting you. And hopefully, you know, you don't get lost on your way to Iowa, but we'll hopefully it's good weather when you come. But would love to see you. Love to meet you and appreciate your time as always.
Thanks, Brian. We'll see you, man.
Yep. Take care.